Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Much as we'd like to forget it, the dismal real estate market is still with us. To be fair, it's trying to bounce back, but today's numbers, well, they kind of landed with a thud. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 16th of June. And this is going to sound like a rhetorical question, but I promise I'm being completely serious. If a given economic indicator has been abysmal for months, then how big a deal is it that said indicator has become less abysmal? The housing news today is one of those depends on how you look at it stories. After a dismal April, home construction did surprisingly well in May. But that's really only half the story, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch explains.
The May figures showed the biggest rise in housing starts came in the region's hardest hit by the housing bust. Economist Edward Lehmer says the biggest jumps were in the West and the South.
And that's suggestive that we're at or near the bottom right now and makes us hopeful that the official recession will end in the middle of the summer.
Still, May was the fourth worst month for new construction in nearly half a century. Housing starts are down 75% from their boom time peak. Lawrence Yoon is chief economist with the National Association of Realtors.
The latest increase is just a bounce from a rock-bottom level of activity that we saw in April.
Yoon says a glut of foreclosed homes has driven down prices and brought back buyers. Builders are responding to that.
But the bad news is that the builders are adding more inventory to the already existing high inventory levels.
With so many existing homes already on the market, why would anyone build? Chris Mayer is Senior Vice Dean at Columbia Business School.
There are people who want to build their dream house, and construction costs are incredibly low, and they view this as an opportunity to do that. You have some builders who are finishing up projects where they got financing, and even though it doesn't make economic sense for them to do it, they're going to finish up the project anyway.
Housing represents only 3% of the U.S. economy. But Michael Englund with the consulting firm Action Economics says economists consider housing a bellwether.
Housing is an extra sensitive sector to longer-term expectations and growth prospects and to interest rates. And so it's essentially the canary in the coal mine.
Englund warns the light at the end of this tunnel could still be months away. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
There was some news out of Washington today that brought to mind one of the more famous newspaper headlines from the 1970s. Talking about the Ford administration's response to New York City's budget problems back then, the Daily News went with Ford to City drop dead. Now it's California on the fiscal ropes, and the Obama administration is telling the state not to count on a federal bailout. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
California officials had hoped the feds would make up for some of the state's expected $24 billion deficit, but former Governor Gray Davis, who faced his own budget woes a decade ago, agrees lawmakers here can solve their own problems.
I think the federal government is saying, you show us you have the mettle to do something in Sacramento. Don't just come whining to us. We're not going to abandon you, but you have to go first. That's how I read their message.
Davis points out his successor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, has predicted revenue near where it was when Davis was governor.
We can afford the level of government we had in 1999, which, as I recall, was pretty good. Now, is it painful? Absolutely. But life is all about choices.
The question is whether lawmakers will have the political will to make those choices. Governor Schwarzenegger was sounding doubtful but hopeful earlier this month.
People are writing California off. They're talking about the end of the California dream. They don't believe that we in this room have the courage and the determination to do what needs to be done, or that the state is even manageable. Let's prove all of the pundits wrong.
At San Francisco State University, political science professor Graham Boucher fears it's coming down to brinkmanship.
You know, I've heard from the right Republicans who really think this is the step towards, you know, drowning government in the bathtub, right? Forcing government to become smaller. On the other hand, there are Democrats I've heard talk who actually welcome the budget crisis because they think the state will be forced to revise how we go about budgeting to enable California's Democratic majority to raise taxes and to expand government more easily.
So could the state end up running out of money to pay its bills? Boucher hopes not, but says he can't rule it out. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
One of the world's best-known broadcasters suffered a setback today. The BBC learned that it might lose some of its funding. The Beeb is state-owned. It carries no advertising. Most of its revenue comes from a kind of tax called the license fee. And today, the British government suggested that the BBC might be asked to share some of that money with its commercial competition. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Commercial broadcasters in Britain have long resented the public largesse enjoyed by the BBC. Viewers foot the bill. Virtually everyone who owns a TV has to pay around $230 a year for the privilege. This so-called license fee raises $5.75 billion for the Beeb. Meanwhile, commercial TV and radio have seen their advertising revenues collapse. Today, as part of a wide-ranging set of proposals, Communications Minister Lord Carter suggested a solution.
We think there is an important service provided by other news organisations alongside the BBC, and we make it equally clear that we recognise they need funding. But we're asking for the first time whether the licence fees should be shared, and I think that's worthy of a public debate.
Not according to the BBC, which says it'll fight the plan tooth and nail. Former chairman Sir Christopher Bland says the government should not be seeking to sap the Beeb's financial strength.
We have one world-class broadcaster in the BBC. It's the best in the United Kingdom and in Europe, the biggest exporter of programmes outside the US. And you shouldn't do anything that will undermine it.
The government has promised a period of consultation over the plan. If it is put into effect, the BBC may consider itself a victim of the recession. While private sector revenues are shrinking, the Beeb's taxpayer-funded billions seem an embarrassment of riches. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
No riches at all on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a school of thought that says a down economy is the perfect time to take risks, to go out on a limb and see if you can't grab more market share or bump up your profit margins. Counterintuitive though that may be, that's exactly what's happening in the hedge fund industry. Even though the average fund lost nearly 20% last year and skittish investors are still pulling their money out and new regulations are probably right around the corner, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports new hedge funds are opening up all over the place.
John Brynjolfsson spent 20 years at PIMCO. It's one of the country's largest money managers. But 4 months ago, he launched a new hedge fund called Armored Wolf. With the competition taking a beating, Brynjolfsson says the market was rife with opportunity and good people.
We've been able to attract and retain, you know, world-class talent moving out from the major financial centers of London or New York or San Francisco to join us here.
Roughly 150 hedge funds were born in the first quarter of this year, but raising money hasn't been easy, and more hedge funds have closed than opened. Kristen Fox is a consultant to hedge funds and their investors.
People are gun-shy. Between the education factor and just plain the fear factor, the money is slow coming back in.
Much of it's going to big names in the business. Bloomberg News reports today that an ex-Deutsche Bank trader has raised more than $1 billion for his new fund. Charles Gradante tracks the industry at the Hennessy Group. He says pension funds and endowments are one source of cash. Having lost 30% in the stock market last year, he says many are moving into hedge funds since they can profit in both good and bad markets.
If you're a pension plan and the baby boomers are now retiring, in droves, you are Bambi at the brook, and the gun pointed at you is the stock market.
Hedge funds are off limits to most of us, but their revival could help ease the recession. The money they pour into the system could lubricate the markets and get credit flowing again. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This may not be what you want to hear in the middle of the worst recession in 75 years, but the market, it has no idea what it's doing. Believe it or not, that's a fairly recent discovery. There was a model that dominated economics for almost 40 years. It's called the rational market theory. And what it said, in a very brief nutshell, is that the market is always right. That if the Dow closes at 8,500 on a Friday and falls 300 points the following Monday, that's what's supposed to happen because the market is rational. It sounds crazy, I know, but it is a really important concept. And to explain why, we've called Time magazine columnist Justin Fox. His new book is called The Myth of the Rational Market.
I think what started this whole way of thinking was a lot of research done in the late 50s and early 60s, sort of revealing that mutual funds in general didn't beat the market, that any sort of new news about a company was reflected almost immediately in its stock price. So I think a lot of people saw that research and put it all together and thought, okay, this means the market is, you can't outsmart it. And if the market can't be outsmarted, that must mean it's really smart and that the prices on the market are right.
Well, then how do we explain something as completely non-rational as the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble? I mean, those kinds of things sort of seem irrational on their faces.
Well, and they've basically caused almost everyone in academic finance and economics to retreat from this idea that the market is rational. But I still feel like, especially in the 90s, and to a certain extent in the last few years, this belief that the market knows best, even when it was somewhat discredited, still had this great power in society, among financial regulators, definitely at the Federal Reserve, and sort of steered our actions during the housing bubble and the dot-com bubble.
Explore that a little bit farther. By steering, do you mean that belief in this theory of the rational market, did that cause regulators to back off a little bit and say, you know what, market's going to figure this out. It's going to take care of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think with the housing bubble, that's very clear to see because Bob Shiller, who's sort of one of the great rebels in my book, the Yale economist who's been kind of arguing against the rational market idea since the late 70s, he'd been saying for the past 7 or 8 years, gee, look, real estate prices have gone up faster over the past few years than at any time in recorded history. That probably means they'll eventually fall. And all of these economists at the Fed and elsewhere would write papers basically starting from the point, well, they probably rose for a reason. Let's write a paper discussing all the reasons why they've risen so much. And I think that ended up being this excuse for inaction on the regulatory front.
Why do you suppose it is that for so long and in the face of contradictory evidence, so many smart people hung on to this idea? I mean, it took Alan Greenspan like 45 years to finally come around and say, you know what, this market makes no sense.
I think with Greenspan, it was partly personal experience in the late 90s where he was dubious of the rise in stock prices. And he got up and made a speech about irrational exuberance and the market made him look stupid. And he writes in his memoirs that basically decided then, you know, that was my last attempt at trying to argue the market down. Hmm. And so I think part of this is just this natural consequence of a rising market.
Yeah. So we were all suckers, right?
Yeah.
As we bounce along the muddy bottom here of this recession and hopefully find some turn on the upside in the not too distant future, what's the model of the market going to be?
To me, the point is not finding the perfect model of the market. It's sort of realizing that the market is a great thing. But I do think over the past 15, 20, 25 years that we've moved more and more towards sort of just deferring to the market. And I think it's healthy to have periods when we don't do that, when we still have the markets and we still rely on them to do things, but we're constantly challenging the outcomes that they deliver.
So if 15, 20 years of rational market belief led regulators to pull back, can we now assume that knowing that the market's not really rational, regulators are going to step in again?
Obviously, one of the problems is regulators are probably irrational, too. I know I'm irrational. And so there's not any perfect solution here. I think we're going to have market bubbles and busts. That's just going to happen, and I don't think we should try to stop it. What's really dangerous is lending money based on asset values during a bubble like that. So I do think one of the things that we're going to get out of regulation is restrictions on leverage, on borrowing. And that makes a certain amount of sense given the story I tell in my book.
Justin Fox is a business and economics correspondent for Time magazine. His book is called The Myth of the Rational Market. Justin, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
At the U.S. Patent Office today, 89-year-old Zalman Shapiro was presented with his 15th patent. I could give you the technical definition of what he did, but think of it this way. We might soon be seeing a lot of bigger and cheaper diamond engagement rings out there. I'll let Dr. Shapiro explain his new way to mass-produce man-made bling.
What I have done is I have combined the issue of solubility of carbon in liquid metal with the formation of crystals of diamond. Not only will it make it less expensive, but it will also make them more uniform in quality. They will be more available. And because they're going to be cheaper, they will be used for various other technological purposes which have not yet been developed. Jewelry will become much more affordable, and therefore there will be much more available of various kinds. They may even decorate some of their pets with jewelry. Because of the unique properties of diamond, it's the hardest material known to man at this point. And its reflectivity and its refractivity and the fact that it is stiff and transparent. One of the most important properties is the fact that it has a very high thermal conductivity. And that's why, incidentally, the nickname for diamonds is ice. And the reason for that is because if you put the diamond against your skin, it conducts the heat away so quickly that it feels cold. Diamonds have been synthesized in the last 50 years, roughly. And I was working at Johns Hopkins, where I got my degrees, in 1942, during the World War II. And my professor, under whom I was working, was very much interested in diamonds. And so I became interested at that time. He was trying all kinds of methods of synthesizing diamonds and failed. But anyhow, since that time, I've been interested in following it. Persistence is absolutely essential. You have to be persistent, otherwise you can't come up with anything unless you're persistent.
A very persistent 89-year-old Zalman Shapiro in Washington today to receive his 15th patent on mass-producing diamonds. Coming up, birth rates can be a pretty useful economic guidepost, except for one thing.
Because it's kind of what you might call a lagging indicator, because it takes 9 months.
But first, let's do the numbers. Mixed economic data and weak retail sales led to another disappointing day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials fell 107 points, 1.25%, closed at 8,504 today. The NASDAQ gave up 20 points, 1.1%, settled at 1796. The S&P 500 pushed back 11 points, 1.2%, wrapped up at 911. Telecom shares got hung up after Barclays downgraded the whole sector. AT&T dialed back 1.75%. Verizon dropped 0.2%. TW Telecom lost nearly 3% today. Sagging consumer demand left retailers holding the bag. Best Buy, the world's largest electronics retailer, forfeited 7.25% today. Limited Brands and Macy's both took back more than 5%. Walmart even slipped nearly 0.5% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter. People are talking about business and the economy at Gather.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
from the Marketplace Statebook. Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department lets us know how much consumers in metropolitan areas are paying for goods. It releases the Consumer Price Index for May. The Senate Special Aging Committee discusses Social Security in the 21st century. And star of the tennis court, Venus Williams, turns 29. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We've had big news for a couple of weeks in a row now. GM went under, Chrysler went Italian, the president started going after healthcare. And a lot of news means a lot of letters. We'll start this week with a big story from earlier this year, one that is still on people's minds, the economic stimulus package, more specifically the Buy American provision that was in it. Commentator Mark Perry said last week he thought protectionism like that is a terrible idea. Faye Aldridge from San Bernardino, California, couldn't agree less.
Is Mr. Perry aware that some of the very countries that are complaining about this issue have their own similar provisions in place? Let's face it, we just happen to be one of the largest trade markets, and nobody wants to miss out on the money to be traded. America buying American would surely put a damper on that.
The National Institutes of Health got a big chunk of that stimulus bill, about $10 billion worth to fund research grants. And that, we learned from science reporter Paul Baskin, has led to a flood of grant applications. So many applications that the NIH is having trouble keeping up. Still, Paul said he wasn't sure the money was going to create all that many new jobs. A lot of you wrote in to say we had our logic wrong, including Josh Schimmel, a professor of environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
The largest part of every research grant is to pay the salaries of technicians, postdocs, and student researchers. That directly creates jobs and provides training for people who will in turn develop new technologies and new procedures that will in time fuel new business and new jobs.
Those postdocs are more likely to get hired if they're tall. I talked to Ariane Cohen last week about her latest book, The Tall Book, A Celebration of Life from On High. Not everybody had the stomach for the height argument, though. Carl Gelko of Madison, Wisconsin, was one of them.
I feel so lucky to not be burdened with height. If no one assumed that I was slow or lacked endurance, where would I get the drive to prove them wrong? And with the ability to play almost any position in sports, how would I choose what to specialize in? Think about the dating pool. Being tall would give me so many choices and make finding the one very difficult. Well, at least I don't have to deal with these burdens and have a real excuse for my pay, right?
No matter how tall you are, how much you make, or whether you found the one or not, let us know what you think about what you hear on the program. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. Recessions have this nasty way of messing with people's plans. If you lose your job or your hours get cut, you probably can't take that vacation you've been counting on or replace the old clunker you've been driving. But for some couples, a bad economy is the perfect time for a little addition. Tamara Keith explains.
A recession is a time to hunker down, work harder than ever, and avoid extra expenses. Oh, like, say, maternity clothes and diapers. Or is it?
I'm the baby.
You're the baby? Oh, you want to put it on my tummy like it's on the baby?
Yeah. Sarah Steffens is preparing her almost 3-year-old daughter, Rosie, for the arrival of a baby sister. She admits the timing of this pregnancy may seem a bit unconventional.
Nobody's actually said this to me, but I'm sure that there's people I know who thought that this was some sort of a terrible accident or something.
Last July, Steffens, who lives in Oakland, California, lost her job. She was laid off by the newspaper where she had worked for 9 years. A blow like that would cause a lot of people to put their family plans on hold. But Steffens and her husband came to a very different conclusion.
I think we just decided, well, it's not going to be a great year for my career anyway. And we wanted the kids to be somewhat close in age and, you know, why not?
Steffens has spent her pregnancy doing contract work, which is a pretty standard path for people who've been laid off. The flexible work schedule made it easier for her to coordinate all the doctor's appointments that come with pregnancy. and it gave Steffens time to think about what she wants to do next, since returning to a career in journalism doesn't seem like a particularly viable option.
I think it's a very clever decision.
Ellen Galinsky is president of the Families and Work Institute.
It gives you a break as long as you've got health insurance coverage or unemployment or some other source of income that you can depend on.
Galinsky isn't surprised that some women are choosing to weather the recession with motherhood.
This country is increasingly becoming family-centric. There is much more of an emphasis on children and families and being with them and taking good care of them than there has been before.
At this point, there are no solid statistics to tell us how the recession is affecting the birth rate. Stephanie Ventura, a demographer with the National Center for Health Statistics, says historically, in a serious economic downturn, births have fallen or flattened out. The latest data she has only goes through last July, so it's a little too soon to tell this time around.
Because it's kind of what you might call a lagging indicator, because it takes 9 months.
Ultimately, Ventura says the data will reflect a lot of different personal choices, those who put off pregnancy, and those who went ahead in spite of the recession.
There's more than 4 million babies born every year, so that's a lot of decisions. And of course, there are some non-decisions.
The decision to have a recession baby just became a reality for Sarah Steffens. She welcomed little June Susan into the world 11 months to the day after she was laid off. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, social media, as you may have heard, is playing a big role in the protests that have been happening in Iran since the election there last week. Opponents of the government have been using things like Facebook and Twitter to get people into the streets, and the State Department has noticed. Reuters is reporting today that the State Department called Twitter over the weekend and asked the company to delay an upgrade that could have interrupted service in Iran. Wouldn't have cost the company much, probably, since it's still trying to figure out how to make money 140 characters at a time. I don't know, social unrest as a business model, anybody? That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dipped 107 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ fell 20 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 lost 11 points, 1.2% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. Coming up next time on this program, engineers face a tough choice. Take a layoff or take a pay cut.
You know, it's pretty common knowledge that IBM has been offshoring jobs. So this is sort of, you know, like a cold slap in the face.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.